to another episode of the Trifecta Podcast. I'm your host, Jack, and with me today are my guests.
It's Melissa.
And I'm Cassandra.
Oh, and something else I forgot to mention is that both of my guests have podcasts. They are on podcasts themselves, so if you would like to talk about your podcast, now is the time.
Sure. Yeah, I'll go first this time. So I'm from Lord of the Rings Minute, which is a podcast where we talk about the Lord of the Rings extended trilogy 1 minute at a time. It is a lot of fun. It's kind of crazy. We're on Two Towers right now, so we have over 300 episodes, and we release Monday through Friday. And I'm also on another couple other podcasts. You can find all of those at duelinggenre.com.
I have a weekly pop culture review show called The Review Show. It's on a network called The Whatnots. Knots spelled like N-A-U-T-S, like an astronaut. So you can just look up The Whatnots and you'll find us. And every week we cover a movie or a TV show, an anime, a comic book, all kinds of different things. And then I am also a cast member on the live play RPG podcast, The Lost Library. I am in a Monster of the Week is the name of the game, and I am in a Monster of the Week campaign called Grayscale.
Oh, fun.
It's a show with a large cast, so I'm not in all the episodes, but they are. Go listen to all of them. We're creating a beautiful story together.
That's awesome. I love RPGs. That's really cool.
Fun time. So today's topic that we're going to be discussing is Guillermo del Toro, the director, and his three most recent films, which are Pacific Rim, Crimson Peak, and The Shape of Water. And I chose this just because those are the movies that I'm the most familiar with myself, and just really wanted to talk about them in more depth. So going into background, first and foremost, I still haven't seen a lot of his older films, but I have a great appreciation for him as a filmmaker and screenwriter from the movies that I have seen. Surprisingly, I have not had a theatrical experience with any of these.
Oh my goodness.
I watched Pacific Rim for the first time at Melissa's house, which was like a cinematic experience because of the huge TV screen that we watched it on.
Yeah, for my dad's 60th birthday, he bought himself a 60-inch screen.
Oh my god. Good for him, honestly. Like, whatever.
And a sound bar, so it is incredibly immersive. It is our own little theater experience at home when he lets me watch a movie there.
That's awesome.
It's a good time. And yeah, besides that, I've only seen bits and pieces of Crimson Peak until now. And I really wanted to see Shape of Water in theaters, but I didn't get around to it until it was on DVD. But the first day it came out on DVD, I went to the local video store to rent it because that's something I still like to do. And I think I first became aware of Guillermo del Toro when I heard news that he was attached to a Haunted Mansion reboot.
Oh, yeah.
Which never happened, but I see that aesthetic put to great use in Crimson Peak. So yes. Glad we kind of got a little chunk of what he probably would have done with a film of similar grandeur.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen a whole lot of Guillermo del Toro's earlier stuff because I'm not a big horror movie fan. I get scared really easily. So I think the only movies of his that I've seen is Hellboy. I've seen like half of Pan's Labyrinth and then these three. So I was really excited that you were looking for guests for this episode because I love these three movies with like all of my heart. I saw Pacific Rim like 4 times in theaters. And then I saw Crimson Peak and Shape of Water both once in theaters each. And those are the only one time that I've seen both of those, but I've seen Pacific Rim a bunch. I love that movie. It's so dumb and silly, but we'll talk about it.
I first saw the Hellboy movie, both of them that he directed. I've got an older brother who's really into the Hellboy comics, and I watched those because I wanted to like cool things that my cool older brother also liked. So I watched the first Hellboy, and I'm like, okay, all right. And then I went to see Hellboy 2 in the theater, and that is still one of the most fun theater experiences I have ever had. I really need to sit down and watch both of those together again, because it's really just to get to that second one. The second one I remember being so magical, and I really hope it is still that strong when I get to rewatch it again, hopefully sometime soon. I was excited for Pacific Rim. I also saw that one in the theater. I saw Crimson Peak in the theater. I did not get out to see The Shape of Water. I watched that on DVD the day before this recording. Wish I would have seen it in a theater, though. It looks beautiful. And I have seen Blade 2.
I guess, yeah. Okay, I have seen that. I watched all the Blade movies in college because one of my friends was super into them, but I was just like, I'm a Buffy the Vampire person. I don't know about this. But yeah, I can see Blade 2. That's funny.
Very nice. First and foremost, we'll start with Pacific Rim, kind of going in chronological order of the year that they were released. So this one was released in 2013. And I'm going to read the Wikipedia description of what these films' genres are, because Guillermo is a man of many genres, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
So this one is described as a science fiction film. Pretty straightforward, but you know, it's interesting. I wouldn't necessarily, off the top of my head, think of this as a science fiction film.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's definitely a movie that has components that have stuck with me throughout the years. Drift compatible is a phrase that I still use very regularly.
Mm-hmm.
I love the score. The score is such a banger.
So good.
It's amazing. It's more campy than I remember. Like, when I rewatched this, I kind of forgot that it was a lot more silly. In my head, I imagine it as much more serious than it actually is. So mm-hmm. It was kind of funny revisiting this. A lot of the big action sequences happen in the dark and in the rain, which kind of takes a bit of the excitement away. It's like hard to see exactly what's going on. And you have all these beautiful Jaegers and kaiju. Mm-hmm. And I wish that we could actually see more of them.
Yeah.
Like they obviously put the work into the CGI, and I wish we could have a better look at it. I think Newt is my favorite character, though, and I would love for him to be, like, the main protagonist of another film just because he's so entertaining. I put in all caps, I forgot there was a dog.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot there was a dog in this movie. And the last note I have is that the little girl who plays young Mako is a damn good actress.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's precious. She has such good range in just like the one or two scenes that we see her in. And she's incredibly convincing. And it's hard to do that a lot of the time with kid actors. Or at least when they know that they're acting, because I just recently heard something about the kids in Willy Wonka. Didn't really know that Gene Wilder was going to be saying certain things or doing certain things, so their reactions are very genuine in that, and that's why that movie is held up so well, because they're not really acting, they're genuinely reacting to whatever's going on.
I just suddenly got somersault of that. Ah!
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I have so many. I haven't seen it in a while, but the score is one that gets stuck in my head regularly, and I always forget that the composer, I can't remember his name right now, but I know that he scores Game of Thrones, too, and he's scoring a more, like, bigger movies lately, so whenever I see his name, I'm just like, oh, it's the Pacific Rim guy. Before I saw Pacific Rim for the first time, I watched, like, zero anime. I could tell that it was, like, an homage to something, but, like, I don't know. I like that it's kind of accessible. It's like a mecha anime for like the broad Western audience. And I love that. I really like that these three movies in particular are just like his love letters to different genres that we're talking about. I love that Guillermo del Toro is just a huge weeb. It's so funny to me. The thing that also strikes me the most important about Pacific Rim is how the lead, like the male lead and the female lead, they don't have an explicit romantic relationship. It's like on-screen platonic, and you can read it as romantic, but that's not the point of the story. And I like that even though it's about Raleigh at first, it's all about like Mako's journey, like steps back and lets her get like the closure that she needs, which is like super important to me. So yeah, I love this movie. My friend hadn't seen it ever, so I lent her the DVD and I'm like, you need to watch this right now, because it's such a dumb movie. Like, it's, well, not dumb, it's just like a big fluffy summer blockbuster movie, but there's nothing wrong with that, which I really admire about it. And it, like you were saying earlier, it's super campy, but it like revels in it. It's kind of walking the cusp between like self-awareness and like kind of making fun of it. It kind of reminds me of the Edgar Wright like Cornetto trilogy, where he's like making a movie that's a legitimate thing in the genre, but it's also like a love letter and kind of poking fun at all of the genre tropes, which I really like.
I really liked Pacific Rim when I saw it in the theater, and it has been a movie that has stuck with me and that I have enjoyed even more upon multiple rewatches. Like, it's fun. It's just bright and colorful and action-packed and fun, but it's also got so much heart to it. Like, I love how positive this movie is and that it's all about community and unity and coming together and ignoring any other differences or vendettas or disagreements and just being a united front of humanity, the last parts of humanity left fighting for themselves. The characters are all so lovable, and there's a moment in it that has really stuck with me that I think is, it's very small, but I think it's one of the shining points of this movie. And it is when Raleigh first meets Newt, and he notices that Newt has all of these kaiju tattoos up and down his arms. And, you know, they call him like, oh, he's a kaiju groupie. He loves the things. He's huge fans of them. And Raleigh has seen kaiju destruction firsthand. A kaiju took his brother. He has every reason to, like, take Newt down for this. Like, do you know what you're doing? Do you know how insensitive that is? Do you know how many people a kaiju has killed? But, like, you can tell he has this moment where he thinks, oh, this guy's in the same boat I am. Like, we're all just humans trying to get past these things, just trying to survive. And if that's his method for coping, for staying positive, for like, well, if these things are here, I might as well have fun with it. And so Raleigh is this moment where he turns to Newt and he says, you know, they're not as cool up close. And he's not sharp with it. He's not like, oh, you know, they're not as cool up close. He's not angry. He's just gently kind of reaching out and saying, those things are very dangerous. I hope you understand what you're doing, but I do understand what you are doing. Yes, we're all just coping. We're all coping here. And that's just a tiny moment of really great empathy that I think really speaks to the writing and to the performance and the spirit of this movie overall.
All right, so next up on the dock is Crimson Peak, which was released in 2015, described from the Wikipedia page as a gothic romance film. The next note I have is Dog Alert Story, so I will tell you about the Dog Alert Story. Back when this movie first came out, I received a text from Melissa that says, in all caps, Dog Alert, there is a dog in Crimson Peak, hashtag Dog Alert. And it's funny because I associated the movie with that for the longest time, but then actually watching this movie, I forgot there was a dog in it until the dog shows up. I'm like, that's the Dog Alert! I got so excited. This may just be me never having seen a movie that took place around the same time that featured a dog, but I don't remember seeing many movies that take place within this time era that have dogs in them. So it's very refreshing to see a dog in this kind of setting.
Yeah, I guess it was times of such strife that people couldn't afford a dog and all the things a dog needs. They're just like royal hunting dogs and things like that.
Yeah, it was nice to see a pupper there. And I love how this movie sets off the tone right off the bat, like, it has the red-tinted opening with the Universal logo, and, like, it starts off showing you kind of what's to come with Edith's opening monologue about how ghosts are real and everything, and when this movie gets brutal, it's brutal. Something that I do admire Guillermo for doing this is that the movie uses its R rating to perfect effect, because it's not like throughout this entire movie there's a ton of gore or a ton of violence, but when there is gore and there is violence, it's very intense, and I think that he uses it well to where it's not just constant and in your face. It's more effective when he's like withholding it and then giving it just every now and then.
Yeah, and then another thing it might get an R rating for, not that this was super graphic, is that one sex scene between Tom Hiddleston and, I'm glad you said her name is Edith, because I don't remember the names of anybody in this movie. As far as I'm concerned, Tom's name is Tom. Like, they have a brief sex scene that is brief, and it's not graphic, but I remember it. It's effective. It's a very well-done sex scene for what it is.
Yeah, and I think seeing this movie in bits and pieces before watching the whole thing made me a little bit too aware of what was going to happen. So there wasn't an adequate amount of dramatic tension or suspense building for me personally. So I kind of wish that I had seen this movie not knowing, oh, these siblings are having sex with each other and mm-hmm. all of this stuff that may have been more of a shock going into this movie, not, you know, having kind mm-hmm. of halfway seen it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think my experience would have been a lot better if it were more going into things in the dark, not knowing. But I think the closing monologue and visuals are so beautiful and so well told that I wish more of the movie would have been this. I wish that we would have seen more of what the closing monologue tries to encapsulate the entire movie as, if that makes sense at all. I guess I wish I just would have seen a lot less of Edith being courted by,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to go with Thomas, because I think that is his name, maybe like Thomas Sharp or something. Maybe I have the name wrong. He just seems like a Thomas in this. But yeah, I wish I could have seen less of that and then focused more on the house itself or more on Edith's experiences with the ghost, because we see some of that, but I just would have liked to see more of it.
I 100% saw this movie because Tom Hiddleston was going to be in it. and I was just like, oh, it's directed by Guillermo del Toro. That's an added bonus. However, I'm here for the Hiddleston. He is such a good actor. I'm super biased, but he's so good in this. I love him as like the tall, dark, mysterious, like broody romantic lead. And I love that Charlie Hunnam is in this one too. As a puppy dog. That's basically what I like. He's a puppy dog in Pacific Rim and he's a puppy dog in Crimson Peak. The gothic with a capital G romance genre is one that I really enjoy reading. So like the Brontes and just like Frankenstein and Dracula and stuff. So when I saw the movie, because they marketed it as a straight horror movie, so I was prepared to be, I was gonna like suffer through it, basically. But I ended up like liking it way more than I thought I would, because it played up these themes of the more like gothic horror romance instead of just straight horror. I don't know. I love that it subverts expectations in that way. I'm sad that you were expecting something different, I guess. Like, your expectations kind of ruined your first viewing of it. So I'm interested to see what you think, like, returning to it. And I honestly have only seen this once, so I'm interested to see how it holds up, like, knowing the twist going into it. But I love the symbolism of, like, the moths and the butterflies. The costume design is gorgeous. Like, everything that Jessica Chastain wears is amazing. And it's wardrobe goals. I agree with you about the gore. Like, when he uses it, it's very effective. While you were talking, the scene that came to mind was the one with the father in the bathroom. I don't know. And I love his use of color just in movies in general. Like, because there's like a bunch of different meta about the use of color in Pacific Rim, like the blue light versus like red light when it comes to Raleigh and Mako. So I want to see if he does something similar with Crimson Peak, if there's like a significance to, obviously there's a significance to red, but I want to know, like, I don't know. I really like picking movies apart, obviously, because I run a movie podcast. but I don't know. I was really impressed with this movie and I enjoyed it more than I thought I would, but it's not one that I find myself wanting to rewatch over and over again. So I think around Halloween, I'm probably going to pick it up and buy it, because then I'll be in the mood for a spooky movie.
I think Crimson Peak is a movie that's trying to do something so specific, and it does it really well. Not to overly plug this, but on an episode of that review show podcast I do, we did an episode about Mel Brooks' Young Frankenstein.
Oh, cool.
And I described it as just pure concentrated trope. And I feel the same about Crimson Peak. I feel like those are opposite sides of like the same gothic coin, whereas one is more like horror and one is more like romance and tragedy. This is an uncomfortable movie to watch with the twist at the end, but I completely understand why it is there. It makes absolute sense. That is the most gothic thing Guillermo del Toro could have thrown into this movie. And I admire him for going every place he goes to. He wanted to tell a scary, chilling, twisted gothic horror story. And that's what he did. Exactly. It's a perfect execution of his goals, I think. And I really understand and admire that. I think this movie is structured and paced pretty well. Like, I think it does take there's a lot of time spent with the courting before you get to the actual Crimson Peak. But I think the way it uses its tension, it does that well. Like, there's a lot of things that the audience knows that Edith does not know. But you're not spending all that time, like, waiting for her to catch up. Like, hurry up, figure it out. Like, you understand why she doesn't know things. And it just creates this dramatic irony and this tension inside you, the viewer, that it just, like, sustains. And then it's this giant crescendo. And when she's finally able to put everything together, like, she thinks the siblings are a couple and are lying about being siblings. And then when they're like, oh, no, we're both. The audience isn't like, oh, Edith, you fool, you should have put it together. It's like, Edith, you fool. Like, it's just tragic. The entire thing that she can't put it together and she cannot confront that truth until the very end. This is real, like, classic storytelling. This is a very literary movie. And I think it also has little bonus details that are pretty interesting. Like the beginning of the movie where Edith comes from, it's set in Buffalo, New York. I've never seen a story set in Buffalo, New York. This whole genre is such like a British thing to have it set in like a smaller American town, I think is a very unique choice. And also Charlie Hunnam, he's in this too, and he plays an optometrist.
I know, I love that.
Just again, very specific, very uncommon, and not a part of the usual set of accoutrements that go along with this trope, with this genre. He's the guy who kind of saves the day at the end. He's the ultimate real love interest. He's the hunk of the piece. Optometrist is not a hunky profession.
That we know of.
Yeah, we're going to go to where are their optometrists? A lens crafters?
Oh, yeah. Hop in a time machine. Go back to Jamestown Mall. Go to lens crafters.
Just scout out the Charlie Hunnam for ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
I like that he's able to add to a genre that's literally hundreds of years old and, like, bring more to the conversation. And it's super cool that he's, I don't know, I don't think I've ever seen a movie, like, decadent is the word, like you said earlier. Like, this movie is just, oh, it's so good. It's like a chef kiss. I don't know. Like.
So there's a couple things I forgot to mention because I don't have them in my notes about Crimson Peak. But first of all, which I'll get into the budget for Shape of Water when we talk about Shape of Water. But I also looked at the budget for this movie and it had a $55 million budget, which is very modest for such a grand scale movie like this.
Yeah, that seems really low.
And it's amazing that they could pull it off with that kind of budget. And then also, it's very interesting because this movie, when I was watching it, it feels like such a classic movie. Maybe it's because of the time it's depicting or the type of literary genre that it's. I just found it so fascinating that a movie like this was released in 2015. And I don't necessarily know what time era it would fit better in. It just doesn't seem like a movie that would have come out within that time. Like, the same year that Ant-Man came out, this movie came out. And that's just baffling to me. So moving into The Shape of Water, released in 2017, described as a romantic, dark fantasy drama, which I think it checks off all of those boxes. I think this movie has incredibly beautiful, lavish visuals. I love the opening scene where we see Eliza's apartment underwater. That's just gorgeous to look at. This movie had a $19.5 million budget.
That's amazing.
That is shocking to me, like how much this movie does and how one of the main characters is this fantastic creature made up of costuming and I'm sure some supplementary digital effects, and that it uses so much water and it's a period piece. I don't know how they could have made this thing for that cheap unless, like, the cast and crew was fed on map testing snacks. Like, here's a packet of Lance's cheese and crackers for you to eat today. We have to cut the budget somewhere, and it's here. Like, I do not know how that would have come together.
I don't either. And just, it's shot so beautifully, too. Like, they obviously didn't cheap out on the equipment or anything. Yeah, it's crazy, but I really enjoy how sex positive this movie is. I think that's a refreshing take.
Yeah.
And I'm so thrilled that this movie received a ton of praise, because I think it's going to open the doors for Guillermo del Toro to do so many other things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just glad that, you know, it won Best Picture.
I
also really appreciate how a lot of Best Picture winners are doused in tragedy. So when I watched this, I kept waiting for something really tragic to happen at the end. And I was waiting for a sad ending. And the fact that this movie has such a beautiful, kind of uplifting ending.
Yeah.
Like a fairy tale ending. It was just very heartwarming to me, and I was very pleasantly surprised that we were able to get a movie that has this kind of ending winning such a prestigious award. Usually it seems like you have to have the most tragic thing ever in order to win something like that. So I was very happy with that.
Yeah.
I will say that I'm really glad that I saw it in theaters. I almost missed it because it had such a limited release. But that opening montage with her apartment underwater is gorgeous on the big screen. It's so pretty. This was definitely in my top three movies that I saw last year. I don't know that it was my favorite because Coco also came out last year and I love that movie. I love that, I like how unabashed it is. Like, the main character, and it's super cool that she's mute and she signs her way through the whole movie, and then the two characters who get the most speaking lines are a gay man and a black woman. Like, that's super, like, to me that just sums up the shift of Hollywood and also society in general. Like, we're moving to a more, like, positive and diverse society, hopefully. And like you were saying, like, this movie is super sex positive, but also, like, specifically, like, feminine sex positive. Like, her daily routine, it makes me laugh so hard. In the first 5 minutes, it's just like, oh, okay, female masturbation, that's cool, and we're moving on. Like, and I love that he got Doug Jones to play the fish monster, because he's been with Guillermo del Toro since, like, Hellboy. So it's kind of cool. It's kind of like a Hellboy crossover-ish. It's not quite Abe Sapien, but we'll see. I love how it's just a fairy tale. I like that the villain of the fairy tale is, like, a traditional white male, like, toxic masculine, like, just 50s asshole. And that, on top of all of the, like, the diverse casting and everything, that just, like, underscores the theme that's like, hey, this thing that you thought was really awesome probably isn't that awesome, and let's, like, re-examine our relationship with this. I jokingly refer to this movie as, can we swear on this? I jokingly refer to this movie as the fish fucker movie, just because, like, I don't know, but it's good that, I'm glad that it won a Best Picture. Like, that's so crazy. I need to own this movie. I want to watch it again. It's just not one that, it's one I think about a lot, but I don't know if, I'm kind of worried that it won't hold up on a second viewing, but we'll see. Because I enjoyed it so much the first time.
I agree with what you said about it being so sex positive, because this is a very tiny part of the movie, but it's something I am remembering, is that when Michael Shannon goes home to his wife and kids, it's his wife that wants to have sex. It's not like he brings it up and she agrees. Like, nope, that's her idea. And she is, like, flirting with him hard. And I liked her. Michael Shannon, a bad guy. He should not win at the end. But I do feel bad for his wife and kids, because they seemed very sweet and very innocent. This movie also has a lot of heart in it. It has a lot of charm. Like, there's some moments of it that are very sweet and really winsome. And there's other moments that are absolutely visceral, like crushingly visceral. And I don't just mean like when Michael Shannon snaps off his dead fingers. Like, there's different sorts of grotesqueness than that. Like in the pie restaurant where the waiter like seems like a nice guy and then he suddenly becomes so prejudiced and so mean out of nowhere. Like, it hurts you because you know it hurts that artist so much. And it's an important turning point in the film, and it hurts. This movie manages emotions very well to have, for every moment that is a beautiful and magical and heartwarming, it's got something that just like stabs you.
Yeah.
This movie has a lot of great details in it, and I love the world building of it, even though it's the most recent and most down, not the most recent in that it came out last year, but like time-wise, it is the closest to where we are right now in its story. It's set in the 1950s. It's fairly down to earth. It's a period piece, but not that distant of a period piece. It's not like going to like when's Crimson Peak, like the 1800s sometime, and Pacific Rim is in a future, and you have to like design that future and make that future believable. This is much closer, but there's still so much effort put into it. Like, the sets and the costumes and everything look like they're not just period appropriate, but like they really built a world beyond just making sure it looked time appropriate. Like in the science offices, there's like this big mural on the wall by where Michael Shannon's desk is. And the camera never settles on it. You never get a good look at that thing. But just glancing at it, like, I know that mural is something custom designed, and if you look at it, it means something. Like, every frame of this movie feels so beautiful and so deliberate. Like, it is as specific as, like, the artist's Jell-O ad is. I think it's my best work.
I think the thing about this movie, like, the bit of the movie that sums it up the best is how earnest and unexpected, yet like it fits so well. The musical number, I was 100% not expecting there to be a musical number in the middle of this movie, but it just makes so much sense. And that to me like encapsulates the whole movie. Like, there's all these unexpected little bits that somehow are magically woven together into this beautiful tapestry of this movie. And I think Guillermo del Toro is really good about like surprising, like taking unexpected things and turning them in such a way that they're still like, it's familiar but still surprising at the same time, which I really admire him for.
Moving on into the ranking, I ranked Crimson Peak as number 3. I think it looks beautiful. I think it has a lot of interesting dynamics that it's playing with, but it's just not a movie I want to revisit more than like once a year around Halloween time, probably. I think it would be a good Halloween movie. And I think just overall, it will stick with me the least. It has stuck with me the least. But I love it visually for what it is, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. My number 3 is Crimson Peak. I think it's like a really pretty vase. Like, you set it up on a shelf and it's really pretty and you like kind of dust it off every so often, but otherwise it just kind of sits there. It's hard because I feel like that movie is super underrated and it didn't get the attention that it deserves, but like going up against these other two movies, it's really difficult.
I also put Crimson Peak at number 3. It is visually fantastic. The costumes are just decadent in this film. And it goes for something lofty. And I think it does it. I think it is an excellent execution of all of its goals. It is just not terribly rewatchable. Like, I might sit down and watch it all the way through again, maybe one more time. Like I said, it is a good Halloween movie. Mm-hmm. It's just the subject matter makes it kind of uncomfortable to watch. But of course, like I said, I completely understand. Like, I don't fault it that at all. I don't want it to not be there. I get it. Mm-hmm. Do it as much as you want. It makes sense. This is the place to put that thing. You really went for it. You went as gothic as possible. A-okay job. I admire it from afar, like a beautiful vase up on a mantelpiece. Just glance at it, be like, look, looking good, vase. Don't need to get up there on the stepladder and touch you. Stay up there. Keep on going, vase.
I put Pacific Rim as number two because it's more of a big concept movie and it has enough craft and consideration that I can't completely dismiss. But I think this film is very interesting in the fact that it convinces me that it's better than it actually is. Like, when it sits with me, I like it a lot more than when I'm actually watching it, which is a weird phenomena. But I don't know how to put it otherwise, though. It's not that I dislike it. I really like it. Just I think I like it more when it just sits with me rather than when I'm actually experiencing it.
Well, I think I'm going to be a little blasphemous because I've only seen it once. Shape of Water is my number two. If we're just ranking off of favorites, like, Shape of Water is a gorgeous, gorgeous movie, but there are... When I sit down and watch a movie, generally, I like just, like, happy, I don't know, just, like, fluffy, inspiring stuff, and it is... It does have the fairy tale ending, but getting there is kind of arduous sometimes. So, that would be my number two.
I put The Shape of Water at number two.
Okay, good. I don't feel as bad.
It is a fantastic film. I'm so happy it's out there. I'm happy it won that Oscar. I imagine it will have a legacy for years to come. But it does kind of, I admit, have a disadvantage in that I just watched it yesterday. We'll have to see how much it sits with me, although I imagine it will. It is a beautiful movie. It is uplifting. And again, it is such a specific, bizarre thing to try and do, but it succeeds at it 100%. It's a wonderful fairy tale, a beautiful love story, magical, charming, painful. I think the only thing about it that kind of disappointed me is that that artist did not get a love interest at the end. He didn't have a happy ending like I was hoping he would. I thought he might have ended up with the Russian scientist based only on the fact that when the Russian scientist opens up his notebook, he too has some very beautiful drawings of the asset in there.
Yeah, he's like, the best.
These are both single men who like to draw. They should go together, right? Oh, no, I was wrong about that. Just wishful thinking on my part.
I hope there's fan fiction out there about those characters.
I am certain that there is.
I actually, like, I will guarantee you that there's probably fanfic of them out there.
Well, I ranked The Shape of Water as number one. I think it's such a unique, charming movie that executes what it wants to do perfectly. Also, just because of personal preferences, I love space and I love beaches. Those are like my two aesthetics. So just imagine the space beach at the beginning of Valerian. That's like me as a person. So the water aspect of Shape of Water just naturally appeals me. I'm wearing a Little Mermaid shirt, by the way, as we're recording this. So if, you know, that gives you any insight. Yeah.
That's funny. Pacific Rim's my number one. It came at the right time in my life, I think. Like, that summer I was going through, like, a lot of different changes and just, like, life and emotional and whatever, personal and job changes. And, like, it was just so much fun. And I saw it with so many different people that part of my, like, nostalgia for that movie is watching it with different people that I care about, too. So I think, I don't know, it kind of worked its own magic. Like, it is a big summer blockbuster, but it felt so different than all the other summer blockbusters that were coming out around that same time. It's clearly riding on the, like, superhero and sci-fi fantasy kind of influx that we're having, but it just feels unique and fresh, and like, it made me curious as to the things that he was referencing and like homaging in the work too, which I thought was really cool. Like, hey, this is a thing that I love a lot and I want to share it with a bunch of people with my $200 million budget. So I like that each of his movies, regardless of budget and regardless of genre too, are just, they just feel so personal. It's just like little snapshots of who he is as an artist, and I really admire that too.
I ranked Pacific Rim at number one. It is legitimately one of my favorite movies. I've seen it a lot. It is a movie I return to. And I know it's something special because it is like remapped the way my brain thinks. Like, drift compatible is a terminology I think about all the time. Like, yeah, that guy's cute, but are he and I going to be drift compatible? And, oh, you're my best friend. What are we going to name our Jaeger? Like, I think differently thanks to this movie. It has made itself like a real facet of my life. And recently, my mother asked me, out of nowhere, what's the best pep talk you've ever heard? And I said, oh, it's we're canceling the apocalypse. Like, that's just an incredible moment. It's so inspiring. Like, they put it in all the trailers for a reason. And I would like to think that even if you didn't see the movie, just having seen a trailer, that line has stuck with you because it is, it's uplifting. It's positive. This whole movie is so positive. And the reason my mom was asking what's the best pep talk I've ever heard is, you know, in classic mom fashion, she wanted to tell me about some sad news story where there was like a bunch of little kids that went on a cave exploring trip with their teacher or their coach or somebody, and they got trapped in there during a flood, and these divers had to go in and like get the children out and like swim with them out. And my mom, dwelling on a sad but ultimately inspirational thing the way, you know, just a Catholic mom does, she's like, imagine what you had to tell those little boys to like get them through such a tough situation. We're canceling the apocalypse. Yeah, I guess if somebody told them that, that would work. That would get them to swim out of the caves. So I'm glad things ended positively for future Earth of Pacific Rim and those boys in the cave. You got out of there. Way to go, boys.
Way to go, boys.
Yeah, there's so many great visuals, like visual punches in this movie. Like at the very end when like Gypsy Danger pulls out the sword you didn't know it had.
Right? Yeah. I love that fight in the air. It's such a fist pump moment where she, like, engages the sword. Oh, man. So good. I love Mako. She's so inspiring, and the actress is, like, so good. I, like, forgot for a moment that Idris Elba was in this movie until you said we're canceling the apocalypse. I'm like, oh, yeah, he's in this too, and he's amazing.
There are emotional beats that have the same weight as these cool action-packed visuals like that. Like, I will remember Raleigh turning to Newt and saying very gently, you're not as cool up close as much as I will remember that giant sword. And for a movie to be able to work on big levels and on tiny details like that, I think is a real feat. This is a very, very special movie for me.
That's heartwarming. Very heartwarming to hear. And it's interesting when we talk about how you can tell that Guillermo del Toro puts so much heart and soul into everything he does and how everything feels like a passion project. I watched Pacific Rim Uprising. I didn't plan on watching it just because I hadn't heard good things about it, but, you know, as my family still does, they get movies from the video store, and so it was in my house and my dad was watching it, and so I just kind of, you know, sat in the room while it was on just to see, you know, if I would like it and everything. And unfortunately, it just does not have the same heart and the same soul that it does. And you can tell that it's obviously missing a person who gave it so much life in the first place.
That's sad. I know, that's sad, because I'd heard bad things, well, like mixed things, and I really want to support John Boyega because I love him. But I don't know. I don't know if I can bring myself. Maybe I'll just borrow it from somebody who happens to have it.
But I will say the best part involves Newt.
Ah.
So if you haven't seen it, there's a very fun scene involving him that I will not give spoilers away since you both have not seen it yet, but you know.
I still want to see it. Like, even if it doesn't have the same magic, there's just a piece of that world that is out there and I still need to know what it is. I still need that puzzle piece complete for me. Yeah, Guillermo del Toro is somebody who makes very personal movies. And even though I ranked it second, I think The Shape of Water might be the most personal one because Pacific Rim and Crimson Peak are both like, there's this genre, there's this style of entertainment I really want to do my own best version of. And The Shape of Water is a lot more patchwork. It's a lot more of there's a lot of disparate elements that I am individually a big fan of. What kind of story can I weave these into? Can I do a Cold War creature from the Black Lagoon fairy tale romance? Yes. Yes, you can. Nobody else in the world could have ever done that. And I think Guillermo del Toro, his legacy as a director will persist. My little niece, who is a year and a half old, one of my brothers got her these little stuffed toys of Hellboy and Abe Sapien, and she loves them and she knows their names.
Oh my God, that's so cute.
I don't know if she can say them yet, but like you point at her toy basket and say, why don't you bring Abe over? She goes and she picks up Abe, shows him to you. And we were at a family party recently and she gets out of the car with her mom and she's got little Hellboy there in her arms. And her mom's like, yeah, she just grabbed it on the way out the door. Wouldn't let go of it. So Hellboy's just here to join us today.
I'm glad. That's a good legacy to have.
Mm-hmm.
With a new generation. Well, thank you all for listening to another episode of the Trifecta Podcast. Hope you've enjoyed this episode.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.